Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 26, for November 9th, 2009. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This edition of the podcast features an interview with veteran game designer Brenda Brathwaite and art historian John Sharp. Brenda and John are colleagues and collaborators in the Interactive Design and Game Development program at the Savannah College of Art and Design. And Brenda, as many of you probably already know, worked on the Wizardry series as well as the Jagged Alliance series of games, and she recently released a game called Train, that's received a terrific amount of attention. We discuss that game in the interview, and we talk about how John's rich background in art, and he's also a game designer, influenced Brenda in the conceptual phase of her work on Train. This podcast is sort of a response to the "Are games art" debate, and it's a response that tries to reframe the question into something that I think is more useful, which is to say, I'm interested in the cross-section between art and game design, in the ways that a designer's personal vision and sensibilities converge with his or her skills as a designer in the conceptual and developmental phases of a game. This, it seems to me, is a significantly more productive conversation to have because it presumes that games can, of course, be artistic expressions. So the obvious next step is to ask, you know, how exactly does that work? And that's the question we consider in this conversation, among many other topics that, you know, sort of naturally unfolded as we spoke. So that's the interview, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did preparing it. I want to thank both Brenda and John for spending time talking with me, and I want to encourage you to check out the upcoming conference that John plugs near the end of the show. It features a who's who of game design luminaries, and it zeroes in on some of the very issues that we discuss in the interview. I also hope you'll join me again next month when I gather the Gamers Confab gang together to discuss our favorite games of 2009. So, thanks for listening, everybody, and away we go. I am delighted to welcome two guests to the podcast, both first-time guests and both just a thrill for me to have on, I have to say. The first is Brenda Brathwaite. Brenda teaches game design and development at Savannah College of Art and Design. She's a 25-year-plus veteran of the video game industry, having worked on games like the Wizardry series, Jagged Alliance series, and others. She's an active member of the International Game Developers Association, and she's been a featured speaker several times at the Game Developers Conference and other venues. She is also the author of two books, Sex in Video Games and Challenges for Game Designers, which she co-authored with Ian Schreiber. And last month, Brenda's tabletop game, Train, received the Vanguard Award at IndieCade for pushing the boundaries of game design and showing what games can do. Brenda also writes a blog called Applied Game Design, to which my other guest, John, is also a contributor. And Brenda, welcome to the podcast. It's a real thrill to have you on.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
She is joined by her friend and colleague, John Sharp, who also teaches at the Savannah College of Art and Design. He has a PhD in art design from Indiana University, a very fine school. How long were you in Bloomington, John?
It's actually art history.
Oh, art history. I'm sorry.
I was there for about 4 years back in the early to mid-90s.
Yeah. Did you like Bloomington?
I really like going to school in Bloomington.
Yeah.
It's an amazing university. It's not my my points of reference prior to Bloomington were New York City and Athens, Georgia.
Right.
Bloomington is neither.
Yeah, I understand. I live in a very small town, so, you know, we go to Bloomington sometimes to see, you know, theater or concerts and stuff. But it's sort of like a nice small town with a big university.
Exactly.
John has interests that range far beyond art history. He's also an interaction designer, information architect. He's a graphic designer, and he's been involved in art and design for many years in a variety of media, including game design. And at the Savannah College of Art and Design, he teaches interactive design and game design criticism and analysis, and many other undergraduate and graduate courses. John recently spoke at the Colorado Game Developers Association on a subject that I think will, you know, be a focus of what we talk about here, on art history for game developers. And he began to advance an argument that people are, I guess, are calling this the ludic age proposition. John, is that sort of the right way of describing it?
Yes, definitely. It's something Eric Zimmerman has been giving talks over the last year on, what he's calling the ludic century.
Yeah.
But prior to that, Brian Sutton Smith had used a very similar term, essentially describing this as the ludic age.
Yeah.
The argument I'm making is that we're leaving a 500-year period that is dominated by visual culture and moving into one that's much more about systems, and within that, games being one of the primary popular vehicles for people thinking about and engaging with systems of the world.
Well, I definitely want to talk about that, so we'll definitely come back to that. But I thought we might begin by just talking a little bit about your interest in game design. Both of you come at it from, I guess, suppose in some ways different angles. But the reason I was especially interested in talking to both of you is because I think that people who are interested in games, and who, I guess you could call them enthusiasts or whatever, but scholars too, seem very focused on the question of games as art. And this has been a kind of a topic for a long time. I think some people are kind of tired of the question, are games art? And it's not really what I'm interested here in. But there is a very powerful intersection between art and game design. And whether or not we call games art, which, you know, I think we should, that point aside, we really don't hear very much conversation or read much about how designers go about envisioning and creating, sort of employing a sense of their own aesthetics and their own sense of art and art history, and how those interests in design and art dovetail in the development stages of a game. And it just seemed to me that the two of you would be ideal people to talk about how that works and how you sort of channel your inspirations and your understanding of art into the games that you design and you're thinking about games. Sort of like a big question, but do one of you want to sort of jump in and see what happens?
Sure, I'll jump in. I mean, several things came to mind while you were talking, and I think it's an interesting pairing, John and I, because, so he's an art historian, you know, first and foremost, I guess, and I'm a game designer. And so my understanding of art history is shockingly limited compared to John's. John's understanding of game design is not shockingly limited. But
you know, much smaller than yours.
But it's, yeah, so he hasn't been doing it for 27 years. And so it's nice to have, I think the only way to really put it is I fell in love with art history. And then I made Train. So the falling in love with art history and that whole field, you know, which actually was enough that it prompted me to change my major. I'm working on a master's degree right now. And so it was significant enough that you know, I went that route and I'm continuing to go that route. But I didn't, as I made Train, I really wasn't intending to make an art game. In fact, it was a design challenge to myself to see if I could capture and express a difficult emotion in a game, if you could do that. And it was very fortunate that, you know, not everybody has an art historian, you know, at the ready, right? But it was fortunate as Train sort of entered into this other area that I had somebody that I could say, well, what's going on? Or, you know, well, how do you think I should handle this? You know, yesterday I was asked, an art historian asked if they could interview me, you know, and that's the sort of stuff that I, you know, talk with John about, or even watching the odd conversations that train that arise around train, like probably one of the biggest ones, is it a game or is it art? Which is an interesting question because, well, I don't know. I mean, first and foremost, to me, it's a system. It is a ludic thing. There's no narrative with train. But whether it's art or not, I don't really feel that that's my judgment to make. I made a game.
Well, I mean, there's historical precedent of systems art going back at least until the 1960s under the name of systems art, and then games have been made by artists since at least the early 20th century. So there's certainly a tradition there, but I think largely this is not very well known by folks in the game development community. I think it's there's not a lot of points of reference there. I think what ultimately typically is the points of reference are popular forms like film, movies and animation and sequential art and that sort of thing are where people are more often coming from, and not the, I'm air quoting, fine arts that Brenda's more kind of tapping into lately. I mean, my entry point to games is very different. I mean, I have 3 college degrees in art history for some insane reason. The whole time I've studied art history and practiced art history, I've been a designer of various ilks. And I've designed a number of games. I've played games my entire life, but I guess I designed my first games commercially back in the mid-90s. But I never really thought of myself as a game designer. I thought of myself probably first and foremost as a graphic designer and an interaction designer. And the way I got into games is I was teaching at Parsons School of Design in their design and technology program. And I thought games functioned as a really great formal exercise for interaction designers. And I went so far as thinking that games were a subset of interaction design. So it was like this little pocket, if you will, within this larger idea of interaction design. And looking back at that now, it was a fairly naive opinion on my part, that I wasn't thinking of games in terms of their expressive potential. I was really strictly thinking of them as this very formal exercise. And one of the things that, I guess about 5 years ago, I started to change my tact in thinking about the expressive possibilities, and the games were a lot more than just interfaces and these interaction systems. And so I think the dialogue I've had with Brenda has further pushed me along this route to more and more think of the expressive potential of games. I don't tend to think of it as much as, I don't use the art word as much as I probably do the sort of expressive way of thinking about it.
Yeah. What was it that made you finally realize that your way of thinking about it wasn't quite complete?
I became a more thoughtful practitioner of game design and sort of thinking about the things you could do with it. It made me realize there was a lot more going on there. Encountering the art games movement and folks like Jason Rohr, I've spent a lot of time over the last year or so talking to Jason and listening to him talk about what he's doing with his games and what he's trying to express in them. Discussing Brenda's work with her over the last couple of years, these started opening up my eyes a lot. And I've been close friends with Eric Zimmerman for more than 15 years at this point. And I think that he definitely informed my thinking. The work he does, he, of course, has done lots and lots of commercial work, but he has a long track record of creating games as artwork. And he's one of the first people I knew that exhibited games in gallery spaces back in the 90s, before this whole phrase art game even really existed.
Yeah.
It's already doing this kind of work.
How does it differ? I mean, when you think about how art works in a sort of traditional setting, there's this gallery and people come in and they look and they may respond in whatever ways, but there's a certain dynamic that changes with a game, which I would imagine, Brenda sort of understands on a very deep level. How does that change the way you're able to gauge what you're doing as a designer? The fact that there's a system in place and there's a person interacting with it.
It doesn't, from a design perspective, I guess that part of it didn't change much for me. Now, there are significant issues with it that arise from it. I guess I'll deal with those first, and then I want to mention something else. The challenge about having your game in a gallery space or in a museum is twofold. I'm currently talking with a museum who wants to have Train there, and part of the problem with that is that in order to interact with it, you know, the game of Train is the rules, and it's what happens when it's in motion. Like, all the pieces and parts just allow you to see what Train is, which is this experiential thing. But museums are reluctant to allow people to touch things, you know, particularly things that have broken glass all over them, which Train has. I mean, the glass isn't a place where, you know, unless you stand up, trip, and fall into it, you're not going to cut yourself. Well, let's hope. But nonetheless, that's potentially problematic. And also, you know, there's one set of rules, there's one set of cards, there's just 60 people, and there's only 6 trains. And so there's, you know, what happens if somebody walks away with it? And actually, at Games for Change in New York, somebody did walk away with the rules. Fortunately, Ian Bogost saw them and, you know, tapped me on the shoulder and pointed at the person, and I was able to go claim them. But, you know, things like that. Another issue is people are also very reluctant to touch anything in a gallery setting. So I had to encourage them and say, you know, if it's digital, people don't hesitate to reach out and touch the keyboard. It could be in the Smithsonian, you know, it just invites touch, right? But my non-digital games, they don't. And so people say, well, can I play? Can I touch it? Yes, that's what it's there for. So putting it in this different context almost breaks the initial intended use of the game.
Yeah, you know, I'll just mention this briefly. I don't mean to interrupt, but Ian Bogost wrote a piece about the sort of gestural nature of your game. That it's a really terrific piece. I'll link to it on my website when I post this. But I think if people are a little unfamiliar with what Train is or what you're doing with it, his pieces would be a really great something that you should read first, I think, before listening to the podcast. So, having said that,
I would agree with that. I would agree. I think the points. One of the things that's come up with Brenda and sort of negotiating things with this one museum is when the game can be accessed as a game versus when the game can be accessed as art. And the primary difference, of course, is it becomes a game when they're actually allowed to play it. And that's something that's having to be scheduled. They can't just walk in the gallery at any point and start playing the game. There's, you know, the vast majority of the time that's going to be sitting in this museum, it's going to be sitting there as this art object, not unlike, you know, a 500-year-old sculpture or something that you are not allowed to touch. Mm-hmm. And that's problematic, but then that's a problem with the museum space in general, right? If you think of Renaissance paintings that hang in the National Gallery in Washington or wherever, they are being used they've been neutered of their context, right? When they were originally in a church or in someone's home where they were these active objects that were used for these very specific purposes. So they were activated. They were allowed to be the thing they were, which were objects as part of rituals in Christian religion. And the second they end up in a museum, they quit getting to be that, and they just become these visual aesthetic things hanging on the wall. And that same transformation is happening to Brenda's game, but it's a bit more fluid because certain times of the day it gets to return to the state of being a game, and the rest of the time it's just this art object.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to go back to this point when John was talking about recognizing that games were something more than this formal exercise. So I think there are a few people who are not familiar with Jackson Pollock. And certainly no Mander is. We kid back and forth about Pollock all the time. But, you know, for me, I knew who Jackson Pollock was, and I knew, you know, a lot of these names, I guess, of the contemporary artists. But they were just sort of there. They were things that you could look at and go, yeah, that's a Jackson Pollock. And then I took this class, and I literally committed. I take this class because I have to, you know, in contemporary art. And I viewed art much the same as John viewed games. It was something I was going to learn. It was interesting. And then I realized, literally, as a game designer, it transformed the way I viewed everything. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's having started with the Apple II, right? So there's been a lot of potential transformations. But when I thought about, you know, somebody like, there's this artist who builds these ginormous sculptures. His name's Richard Serra. And like standing next to one of those and thinking about how space and just slight angles affect level design and affect how you feel. And now, granted, I see it very much through games. I'm still a fairly shallow person in all these other areas outside of games, but that is broadening. But looking at Richard Serra, like, how does that influence how I see all level design now? Or Jackson Pollock's paintings, you know, one thing when people, I guess, rather than defend him, you know, the painting that you're looking at is really an artifact of Pollock's painting experience. And so I started thinking about, specifically in the games that I'm making, what is the artifact of the play experience? What do you walk away from? What is the canvas that is left upon you as a result of this play experience? And I never would have seen it like that if it hadn't have been for having this transformational experience in this 10-week class. And literally, I just feel like I'm at the tip of the iceberg. I talk to a lot of game designers who think, like, seriously, you've lost your mind in art history, like, of all things. It could have been programming or something functional and useful. But it's changing the way I design, and it's incredibly exciting to me. I wish all game designers could get into it and, you know, and also have regular access to a PhD art historian to answer their dozens of questions.
But when you say that it's changed the way you design, it hasn't, in a practical sense, changed the tasks or the process,
no.
Right?
Okay, that's true.
That's still the same, but it's changing what you think you can do through game design, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So that's totally accurate. I mean, with all of the games that I'm doing, the current one I'm working on, One Falls for Each of Us, is about the Native American experience with the Trail of Tears. And I don't think of things like, what can I show on the screen? I don't think of things like, how much time will the game take to play? I don't care about things like, how big is this game going to be, or can it fit into a room? So it's removed a lot of that. I don't care whether it sells or not. I'm not trying to sell it. I mean, it's not for sale. I'm making just one of them. But I don't have any commercial constraints, you know, much like I know certainly many artists, Jackson Pollock included, made paintings that they hoped to sell because they were starving. That's not the case with me. I'm just trying to make what it feels, I guess, right. Yeah, so it's certainly it's removed the constraints that I had, I don't want to say placed upon myself because I wasn't aware that they were there, but just when you grow up, I guess quite literally since I got into the industry at 15, when you grow up in the commercial game industry, you see everything through a commercial lens, whether you're aware of it or not.
You know, I was thinking, my wife and I were in New York a few months ago, and we were at the Museum of Modern Art, and we were looking at some Pollock paintings, and there were kids there in a group, you know, with a school, I guess. And the amazing thing about these kids was that they all have the same sort of reaction because they weren't all in the room at the same time. They came in shifts, so you could sort of see them each respond, you know, kind of fresh. And they all want to touch it. Like, they all wanted to get right up there and touch it. And there's something, like, really primitive about that exposure, that experience that you sort of are watching happen for the first time. And I sort of wondered if there's something about that that's similar to why you made Train a tabletop game, why you've gone from so many years of digital work to this real kind of tactile experience of having things in your hands and putting pieces in boxcars, and that it's very primitive in a way.
I guess no.
Damn.
I know.
That would have been so clever, that connection.
I'm done with it. So the very first reason is that I felt an overwhelming need to make a game. You know, which is something that I, you know, when budding game designers say, you know, they ask questions, you know, if you don't feel a need to consistently make a game, odds are you're not meant to be a game designer. And so I felt this overwhelming need that I had to make a game. And so in order to do that, I found myself without a programming team for the first time in my career. So I had the option of learning to code, and that was going to take a while, right? And I needed to make a game now. And so I started thinking about, and I play a ton of non-digital games as well. So I had already made a prototype for a game called The New World, which is about the Middle Passage, and I prototype a lot in the analog. So I started thinking about, you know, what are the tremendous things what are the benefits of doing things in the analog? And one of them is that you can leave, you know, you can play with the rules a little bit and leave little gaps that are just small enough. You can clearly see what you need to do, but they create a space in which the player along with other players needs to make a decision, like rules lawyering, I guess we would call it, you know, like, give me the rules. I don't believe what you're saying there. And so leaving these little gaps in which the player is building complicity. And so it allowed me to do that. I also didn't want to make it digital because then I would be making many, and I just wanted to make one. I just wanted there to be one because there could be. I've never made one of a game. I've always made, you know, 50,000, a million or whatever of a game, and I wanted there to be just one. And that's something that people still, every time I talk about Train or show Train, people say, well, who's publishing it? Well, I am. You know, like, and there it is. It's done. And people have a difficulty with, well, why aren't I selling it? Why aren't I boxing it and selling copies? Which I think is endemic to that's the commercial industry, right?
I think it's been the fact that Train is non-digital and there is only one has really forced, I think it's a very well-designed game and a very well-thought-through game, but if it had been digital, I'm not sure it would have gotten the same response that you have, right? Because there's all of these things, these certain things you've done that have really forced people to reconsider it as a game and what games can be. You know, and every time you talk about the game, you get these really amazing emotional and intellectual responses from people. But if you were just up there talking about some digital game you'd made, even if it were the same subject matter, I don't think you'd have gotten the same response from people. I think that's really interesting to me, if it's taken stepping back 40 years in some ways and making a game using technologies other than computers that have made people realize some of the potential of the form of game making and gameplay.
Yeah, and it's so an important point here is I could have had this program. There have been many people, including some ridiculously well-known programmers, who have said, we will program Train for you. Even early on, before it was, I guess, released accidentally when I talked about it at a conference. But I didn't. I don't want them programmed. I like them as they are.
Is it more likely that people sort of bring their preconceptions to this, where if it's not digital, it's more likely to be seen as artistic? If it's digital, it's less likely to be seen as artistic?
I thought so. I mean, I felt like a lot of the art games that covered more difficult material were, you know, they got that knee-jerk reaction from mainstream society. Like, I can't imagine if somebody said, you made a game about the Holocaust? Like, that would have just, you know, I mean, if you thought...
Look at the response for the last couple of weeks to Modern Warfare 2 and the two different video clips that have been circulating around the internet and the response they're getting and people's rejection. You know, I don't know anything about the intentions of the publishers and the developers, but there's just this assumption and rejection that a serious issue might be dealt with, or some of the responses that some of the things that have come out of the developer about their intentions in having the player character participate with the Russian terrorists. To sort of explore certain ideas and the sort of horror of, you know, killing these innocent bystanders. People are just outright rejecting the fact that someone could have been trying to explore those ideas in a computer game. And I think Brenda would have probably gotten very similar responses. And in fact, before the game was released, you did get that response from a few people from some people who were from the board game community that sort of primarily centered around Board Game Geek. There were some folks really never seen the game, hadn't even heard Brenda talk about it, but were getting second, third, fourth hand sort of information about the game and were applying these same kinds of rejections to what she had done. But the fact that so far people have only been able to encounter Train in person inside of galleries or at conferences where games are being accorded much more respect, I think that's had a certain amount to do with the reception it's received. But, you know, like Passage, for example, or Braid, or The Marriage, or, you know, any of Daniel Ben-Murguía's games like Today I Die, have had a harder time being seen as art because of the modes of distribution and the places that they're encountered. I remember Brenda and I were at an academic event, and we were with a bunch of folks who primarily were coming from the arts, and this, let's see, a visual effects fellow?
No,
the guy on a film guy who just sort of shook his head and scoffed at the very nature of the very idea that games might be something worth more serious contemplation.
Mm.
And there's a lot of that baggage out there. The fact that Brenda's game wasn't on a computer forced him to at least consider it a little deeper than he would have otherwise.
What's interesting to me is the reaction of the board game people that you were talking about. It reminds me of the kinds of reactions you see to games that do have sort of artistic ambitions or that want to go in a certain kind of way, that it's often the gamers, it's the gaming community that's the loudest in opposition. They don't want games to do that. They don't want games to be that for some reason.
I can remember the first time I played Passage, right? And it took me a few minutes to recalibrate my thinking about what I'm playing this game on a computer. I have these certain assumptions about what that means. What is going on here? Like, why are those assumptions being fairly soundly ignored by this game? And, you know, it took me a few minutes to kind of get my bearing, and the same thing happened again when I played Jason's game Gravitation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Of trying to kind of recalibrate the way I think about things, and given who I am and, you know, my interest in art and games, I was willing to take the time to sort of figure that out, and that's sort of an expectation, if you will, of contemporary art, right? That it's more challenging, and you can't just look at it and very quickly grok what's going on. And mm-hmm. so I was sort of coming from a space where I was willing to realize my preconceptions were not going to apply here, and then try to suss it out on my own. And not everyone's willing to do that. Not everybody's willing to sort of step aside of their own personal and emotional responses and their expectations of what things ought to be in this world. And that, you know, that's very much how some of the board game community responded to train.
Yeah, I think part of the response, which is fine, you know, if you're going to make a game about the Holocaust, you know, you better be prepared for that sort of stuff. And I think part of it is that the game, if you just look at it, you're like, I know exactly how this game is played, which isn't the case at all. I mean, it's possible to save people. There are a lot of different ways to play it. And, you know, other criticisms that, you know, once you know that the game is about the Holocaust, that's it. There's only one ending, and now the game is ruined for you. And that certainly has not been the case in many play sessions at this point. And I do want to say, like, one of the things that was very surprising to me, and continues to be surprising to me, in fact, is the wonderful, incredibly warm reception I have received from the game design community. It was, in fact, about a year ago at this time. Yeah, it was a year ago at this time.
This weekend.
At Project Horseshoe, which is an invite-only game design conference held in Texas, that I happened to be talking about these games that I was working on. And somebody, I think it was Moretzky, Steve Moretzky, said to me, well, what are you going to do with them? And I said, I'm not going to do anything with them. And he said, well, you have to do something with them. You have to talk about them. And so there was this, you know, needling at the end of the table, Dustin Klingman, Steve, David Fox, Jason Rohr, John, you know, that I must go talk about these games somewhere, somehow. And so I agree to do this, and I speak at this little conference, the Triangle Game Summit in North Carolina, and there was a reporter from The Escapist in the room. And so effectively, Train was released that day. But I wasn't planning to talk about it with all these people. And the response, I mean, like, I went to Culver City, you know, I'm there at IndieCade, and I submit Train just because they left out digital in the entry requirements. So I submit Train, and it was an awesome conference, because I did not in any way, shape, or form feel any pressure, like, oh my goodness, my game is up for award, because I knew I wasn't going to get an award, right? You know, and I had a friend who came in from out of town, and you know, just to see Train, he hadn't seen Train before, and so it was really great. And then they said, you know, they do the Vanguard Award, and I hear Brenda, and I'm thinking, I'm the only Brenda here, you know? And it blew me away. I literally was speechless, and that's never happened.
That's the only time I've seen Brenda able to string together 20 straight minutes of speaking.
I didn't even know what to say. I mean, I was just, I was blown away. You know, when other people, like Jaffe, you know, on Twitter, he said something like, well, I mean, making it very family-friendly, he said something like, you made this? Wow, cool. And the reception from the video game community, it's odd, because in some senses, I mean, John may feel differently about this, but I feel like Train is treated like a video game that forgot electricity. Like, it just doesn't have that system, but it seems to be thought of much more, maybe because I'm a video game designer, like it went into the world in a different way than most board games come in.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because it was you and that it wasn't coming from, you know, Rainer, if Rainer Knizia had made it, would they be paying the same amount of attention to it?
German, probably, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it's true that I think in part it's because you're part of the tribe, so to speak, of game designers, right? And so I think it immediately was afforded more respect and at least consideration.
You're part of the tribe, but you're also sort of trying to push the tribe forward in a way. I mean that.
Well, it wasn't intentionally, right? I mean, I just wanted to see if I could do it. You know, I had made a game about the Middle Passage after my daughter came home from school and just had this incredibly light thoughts on this very significant experience. So I made a game to explain it to her, and then I just thought, wow, that was awesome. And then I did it again, and I made a game about the Irish-American experience, so my family's history. And then I decided to do six games because, in fact, I had heard a rumor that Knizia liked to make six games at a time, which I've never been able to substantiate since I heard it. I don't even remember where I heard it. But I wasn't originally, I'm going to push game design forward, because if I would have done that, I don't know what I would have done. Like, that's a pretty lofty thing. I mean, I just wanted to see if I could do with game mechanics what photographers could do with film. And that's all I wanted to see. And working in an academic setting, I had the luxury of not having to worry about my publisher saying, wait, the game's theme is what? You know, I could make whatever I wanted to make. And, you know, being surrounded by, you know, people like John Sharp and Ian Bogost and, the game designers that I mentioned earlier, there wasn't this sense of, like, are you crazy making these? It was like, wow, you know, that's interesting. Let me know how that goes. And I'm still getting that response. But I didn't set out to do this at all. I mean, my goodness, I'm sure if I had set out to say, I'm going to change game design in the next year or something, it would have been an epic fail of monumental proportions.
But you do have a lot of experience in the much more kind of mainstream, we've got to make money industry part of game design, many years of it. How receptive is that sector to this? I mean, do you sense that things are moving in a direction where that's starting to soften up a little bit? Or is that really just a separate space? It'll remain a separate space. There's going to be indie games. And I mean, how much cross-pollination is there really?
Well, I know at the new gig that I'm starting, you know, Train was mentioned repeatedly during the interview phase. I haven't felt, I mean, I'm sure there are people who think, like, she's making what? She lost her mind. Why is she making these board games? But I haven't really felt anything but support, you know, and I have a pretty tight game design circle. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter and see who I talk to pretty regularly, you can see that. And, like, the New World, in fact, the game that's about the Middle Passage, I'm releasing it at Harvey Smith's house. I'm just going to do a private release because I can. Like, that's the great part about these games. So I'm going to release it there. Harvey was one of the designers on Deus Ex, not to mention a bunch of other awesome stuff.
Do you, I'm curious to know if you feel like you've moved to a different place in your career, that you're, I mean, it's no secret you've announced that you're leaving Savannah and you're taking on a new big opportunity. And I know you can't talk about exactly what that is, but I mean, it sounds like you were there, you left, and now you're coming back and you're coming back sort of different. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's completely fair. I am, but I mean, all I've ever thought about is games, right? I mean, I was having a discussion recently with a friend of mine about, you know, that I have a very deep interest in games. I mean, games are my hobby. They're what I want to talk about. They're what I want to do for work. If I'm relaxing, I'd like to be playing a game. I mean, it's really honest to God all I do. It's pretty much games and my car, right? I'm the two of the world.
And it is a way cool car, we have to say. It's an incredibly
cool
car.
All right, must agree. So yeah, sure. I mean, I think, but every game experience changes you, right? I mean, so these game experiences have changed me tremendously. But I can also say, you know, probably one of the worst games I've worked on, which was Playboy. You know, that changed me tremendously in that I thought, okay, what should have gone differently there? I mean, I've heard many noted game designers say, you know, they learned more from games, their failures, games that weren't so good, than they learned from their greatest success.
That's true of any, I mean, that's not something limited to games by any stretch of imagination, right? That's just in life, if we're a willing recipient, we're always going to learn a lot more from our mistakes, I think, than our successes, because we're going to hopefully reflect upon what happened. So,
John, I'm going to sort of transition and talk a little bit about the ludic age proposition, because it seems like it's a good time to do that. It seems to me that part of what you're suggesting here, and I'm interested in you kind of elaborating on what you mean by this, and Zimmerman's mm-hmm. involved in this, like you mentioned, that if you ask the question, are games art, in a certain way, at this point, you're sort of asking the wrong question, that we're, the idea of the visual age is, and that the way we think about that is something that we're sort of moving past into something else. And I'm just curious to have you explain, I suppose, in as a thumbnail, a sketch way as you can, about kind of what you mean by that and why this ludic age is so different.
Sure. I mean, I'll start with the talk I gave in Denver was basically a play test, if you will, of a talk I will be hopefully giving at a much larger conference this coming spring. But anyway, the talk was sort of in some ways born out of Project Horseshoe last year, this very weekend. It's sitting around and talking with Brenda and Jason and Olivier Lejad from Mech and Sleep and other folks like that about the confluence of art and games. And we were working on a report. That's kind of what you do at Project Horseshoe. You tackle some problem through groupthink for 3 days. And the subject we had chosen was, in some ways, the how to help games receive better cultural respect. And sitting there talking with a room full of very successful game developers, I realized that there was not a whole lot of understanding of the history of such things. And repeatedly, I kept coming back to comparisons between what games are going through right now and what went on with the Italian Renaissance and the Renaissance in Europe in general back in the 14th through 16th centuries, where the whole idea we have of art today did not exist prior to that period. I guess what we think of as design today, of these well-crafted functional objects, that's all there was, really. There wasn't the such thing as these objects that we created simply for enjoyment, for aesthetic appreciation, and so on. And I see a lot of parallels to what's going on right now with games. The games were just these kind of, if you will, dispensers of entertainment product, right? That's kind of how we've thought of games, and there's a lot of reasons that are interesting of how that's unfolded over the last 10,000 years. That's kind of the position the games are in right now. And there's a group of people who are endeavoring to change that point of view about what games are. And the same way that, you know, if back in the 16th century, Michelangelo got to be an artist because of his work, because of the work of critics, because of the willingness of certain very rich people to pay. But it was also part of this larger change in culture that became very focused on the visual, on using, if you will, our eyes as a filter, as the primary filter for thinking about the world, and thinking about using the production of images as an important vehicle for expression, for education, for, you know, what have you, almost all facets of life. And that is very much stuck with us. Painting and sculpture became the primary vehicles for visual culture and the fine arts. And then as we came into the 19th century, photography takes their place to a large degree, and then television and film come in after that, and print media all along. And I guess part of what I'm suggesting is the same kind of transformation is just now kicking off for games. The games, what we do with them is changing. What our perceptions of what we can do with them are changing. And in the same way that visual culture, painting, sculpture, very much tied into larger cultural changes back in the Renaissance, I think the same kind of thing is taking place today. You hear a lot of people talk about the information age, right? But that only gets you so far. That's sort of the start. That's almost this fetish over the encyclopedic nature of computing, let's say, right? That, look, we can stick all this data in here. But now what we're starting to come into this period where we're more interested in what we do with it and the systems that are around that and all of the different transformations that can take place. And games are this really nice formal structure for more pure expression, for more pure aesthetic experiences. In the same way that a painting served that function for, or a film might serve that function for a visual culture, I think games serve that function for a ludic culture.
Is it a limiting thing or a liberating thing, or sort of mix of both, the fact that we culturally today, it seems like we look at games as something, as things we consume, that if there's a consumer kind of relationship we have to games, we eat them, basically.
Yeah, well, we eat our films and our TV too, right? You know, I think that's one of those places that's one of the things, that idea that I was a little confused about at first with the way people thought about games, because art's been commercial all along, right? You know, Michelangelo didn't create much of anything just because he wanted to, because he felt like he had to. That whole idea is this, you know, art is this thing that explores the human condition, and Van Gogh chopping his ear off because, you know, he had to, and he painted because of it. He was driven. That's this very romantic 19th century notion. Art's always been commercial. Art's always been a product. It's just been a product afforded a different cultural status, but it's still always a product. So to me, looking at it with a sort of long historical view, I don't see that as a problem at all. However, it is a cultural bit of baggage the games are going to need to get over.
Yeah.
And that's part of what's great about Brenda's Game Train, I think, is that there's only one of them, right? So it totally breaks down the product thing. That's why I think of all of the questions that baffle people about Train, that's always the one that really, that some people have a hard time getting past. Mm. What do you mean you're not going to mass produce it? Yeah. They can't get their heads past it. But I think that's probably the most important thing about Train in terms of its ability to make people think a little differently.
You know, it's awesome along those lines, and it happened right here in Atlanta. We had an opening for a digital media center here, and I was asked to bring Train, and I set it up in a room while class was going on, and this one student was very into, I don't know what the heck he was doing, but whatever it was, he was very into it. And he turned around and said, "Oh my God, it's Train." And the look on his face, like, I think that's, to date, my favorite reaction that I've ever seen, because he didn't even know it was coming, for one. He knew about it, and then he turned around, and it was, like, right there all set up. And just the look on his face and that, you know, that scarcity, it reminded me, although on, I'm sure, a much less significant level, of when I saw Lavender Mist in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian. You know, I sort of approached it with my head down because I wanted to just look up and take it in. And when I did, it blew me away. It just, you could feel the movement in the painting, and it was there. And it was, you know, I sort of made this pilgrimage, not just to see that I was on my way north to see other, actually, in fact, with Train to take it to Parsons. But I, you know, approaching this painting and knowing, like, from Savannah, driving all the way to Washington, and knowing that it was in this museum, and then looking up and seeing it there, was just an incredibly moving experience. And if I had been able to have Lavender Mist in my hallway, it would have diminished that experience.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm. Very much so. Mm. Very much so.
Well, you know, it's not incompatible, the idea that you're talking about how we must buy and sell these things, and it's all, you know, there's a certain market imperative here. But you know, when I listen to Brenda say, this is all I think about. This is what I do. I wake up, I do it for play. I do it for work. It sounds like what novelists say when they talk about writing. It sounds like what painters say when they talk about painting. There's this certain kind of drive that you can't deny, that this is what you are. And that's, I mean, it's one of the ways we describe artists, right? That's what artists do. They it's almost like they can't help it.
Well, there's this great quote. This morning I left an academic conference taking place here in Atlanta, and I gave a talk that was kind of on the difficulty of studying play from the play of historic games, because, it, you know, for one, we don't really have the objects in around, and then two, it's my position that the, you know, play is what games are about, which I guess is a pretty obvious thing, but it received some pretty strong reactions at this academic conference. But anyway, one of the things I was talking about was Marcel Duchamp and his experiences with chess. He has this great quote from, I think it was a TV interview he did, where he's describing chess players as having many of the same qualities that he sees in artists. You know, they're like hairs going all over the place, and they're completely obsessed with this thing, and they live and breathe it, and that's all they can think about. And he said, you know, it's like, I see all of these qualities in chess players that are things that I used to see in artists. And for Duchamp, he was very sad that he felt like some of that sort of that passion and spirit about art had started to fade away in the first half of the 20th century. And he became far more interested in chess than he was in the creation of art. So it's a similar thing there, that, you know, game players and game designers. I think that's another cultural bit of baggage that games are going to have to get past, is this idea that there's something wrong with someone spending all of their time playing games, whereas, you know, a parent who might have two kids, one who plays games all the time and one who reads literature, right? And the parents are going to encourage the kid, perhaps, who's sitting there reading all day long, but they're not going to encourage the kid who's sitting there playing games all day long. But, you know, to be able to see the value in both of those things is something that's starting to change. But, it, you know, it's more in seeing kids play with serious games or educational games.
Yeah. Well, and our ability to study them, to be able to do sort of meaningful assessments of what's happening there is certainly increasing.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It is.
So, Brenda, you were an educator for a time, and I suppose in some ways you'll continue to be an educator, but you've decided to move out of that and back into design. Will you miss anything about that? I mean, has there been something about being a teacher in a kind of formal setting that's been useful to you?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, I'm gonna miss. I can't even tell you how many things I'm gonna miss. I've come close to crying on multiple occasions. You know, the day after it was announced, I had a group of students that showed up all wearing black.
No.
You know, and not. Not because they hated me, you know, but out of sadness. And we're now doing these weekly design get-togethers. So come and ask me whatever you want to ask me that I didn't necessarily get to cover. And I don't view this as that, you know, I'm never going to teach again. This is a tremendous opportunity, and it would have taken a tremendous opportunity to get me away from this. I mean, in many senses, one of the greatest things about having gone into academia was that it removed some of the boundaries that I was not aware were there. And it also gave me time to catch up. Having worked, you know, nonstop as a designer, I really hadn't had the opportunity to read the awesome stuff that had been written or to stop and consider, because you're always going full steam ahead. And, you know, I've had an opportunity now to read a ton and research a ton and, you know, talk to people who have been doing this for years, and I've learned a tremendous amount. I mean, I can't even tell you how much I've learned. It's been a transformative experience, and I'm positive if I were in the industry, the odds of me, you know, running into somebody like John who would have said, by the way, Pollock will, you know, he'll really inform you, study him, you know, randomly at GDC. I can't even fathom how this would have happened. I know that none of the games that I'm currently making, well, none of the non-digital games that I'm currently making would have been made if I had not have taken this route. It simply wouldn't have happened. I can't imagine whatever would have made that come to life.
Well, I just one more quick question. Is it okay? You have just another minute or two?
Sure.
I'm curious from your perspective, both of you, the link between game design schools or schools devoted to teaching game design development and the sort of segue that you would make into the industry from there. I teach at a small liberal arts school. You know, we don't teach game design, but I, you know, just the other day I had a student pop in my office and say, I think I'd like to be a game designer. What should I do? And it seems to me that in the last few years, you know, these programs have started to crop up, and I think it's a little confusing to some people whether that is the best way, or are we doing a good job in undergraduate and graduate realms getting people ready to work in the industry. I'm just curious from your point of view, if you were to take a snapshot of what that looks like, What does it look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's something I think about. I think Brenda and I both think about. We're both fairly deeply involved in the game design curriculum here at SCAD, and we're always reflecting upon that. I'll use another kind of art historical model, that the traditional approach before the 16th century and even well beyond that is continued, but the workshop model of learning a craft was the norm, where you came in as an apprentice. You know, if you were working in a sculpture studio, then your job would be sweeping floors, helping lug bits of marble around, what have you. Eventually, after you'd done that for a while, you'd be allowed to actually touch a chisel and do some of the really kind of crude, rough chiseling to work your way down to the roughed out form. A little while after that, you might be allowed to, let's say you're working on a sculpture of a horse, you might be allowed to have a little more of a detailed touch on the underbelly of the horse, part of it that nobody's going to see, and eventually you'll actually get to do some of the more important parts, like the head of the horse, and then eventually you might actually be allowed to do your own sculpture by yourself. And that model's not very far off from how the game industry has traditionally worked, right? And then in the 16th century, the art academy, essentially the art school, was concocted. And then suddenly you're not working in this commercially based environment anymore. Now you're working in this bit of a vacuum. And so you focus much more on the ideas as well as the techniques. And you spend more time talking about what you're doing. You're not necessarily doing work that's client-driven, or at least deadline and goal-driven in the same way. And that's kind of what it's like still today, even teaching game design, right? And we try to model the commercial environment, but there's still something really different about what we're doing here and the way it takes place, is that always preparing students for the entry-level jobs they're going to receive. We definitely take that seriously, but I don't think we're always, I don't think students are always going to be able to walk in there and do exactly what a company needs. However, they're probably going to be much more articulate about what they're doing. They're going to have a larger vocabulary. Now, whether or not the folks on the industry side embrace that, it's a whole other issue, right? I think increasingly the industry is more receptive to students who have been trained in the university environment, as opposed to coming up through the more workshop model, if you will.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with everything John said. I don't want to make it with a... I think people are getting much more receptive to it. And, one of the things that students need to consider is, to me, still the single most important thing that they need to do is make games.
Yes.
I mean, if you're not making games, there's the fundamental flaw. So above everything else, make games. I have very little patience for the line. I'm a student. I am too busy to play and make games. So when you get into the industry, do you think that you're going to suddenly have more time? So that's challenging. And then the other thing that goes with it also is is what is game design? There are a number of places that would say game design is game art. And game design is these ludic systems and the ability to craft a player experience from. Train is game design, but, so is Doom.
Yeah, you end up with a lot of schools that say they have game design programs that actually have programming programs or game art programs, but they're not actually game design programs. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I always tell my students, that I'm going to transform them from knuckleheads into game developers, or putting it in a nicer way, transform them from fans into reflective practitioners, right? Mm. And the academic environment today allows them to remain fans a little longer than they probably should, in a way that they would get weeded out way quicker if they happen to get lucky enough to land a job in the industry. I think they would be forced to reconcile the difference between liking to play games and making games much more quickly than it sometimes happens in the school environment.
Yeah, I show them a picture of my car and say that any of them could drive this, theoretically, and then show them a picture of the engine and point out that few of them could build it. And that's what they're coming to school for, is to learn how this engine is built.
And how to go build their own.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, this has been terrific. It's an hour later, and I think we just started talking. Thank you so much for your time, both of you, John and Brenda. I'm so grateful. And Brenda, all the best luck in the next step forward for you. And I look forward to hearing what that is sometime soon, I hope.
Great. Thank you.
May I plug one thing before we...
Oh, absolutely. Plug away.
Sure. Thanks. SCAD and Georgia Tech, along with the High Museum of Art, are organizing a conference that's going to run this February, the Art History of Games. It's myself, Ian Bogost, and Michael Nietzsche, both of Georgia Tech, are the ones organizing this. And it's going to be dealing with a lot of these same issues that have come up in conversation today. We've got a number of different speakers. Brenda is going to be coming back into town to speak. John Romero is coming to speak. Frank Lance, Jesper Yule, so a number of different people from the game studies and game development community, but then also folks like Christian Paul, who's a curator from the Whitney, who's taken an interest in systems art and games, will be coming to speak. So it's going to be a pretty amazing event. We've commissioned three games. Then the only requirement we put on these commissions were that, one, they'd be playable games, and two, that the folks who commissioned them from consider them to be works of art. And so those three people are Jason Rohr, Eric Zimmerman, and then Tale of Tales, the folks who created The Path. Yeah. And
that's an interesting trio. That's going to be, and this is in February.
Yeah, it's February 4th through 6th here in Atlanta at the High Museum of Art.
Cool. Wow.
And, yeah, the website's arthistoryofgames.com.
Okay. I'll make sure I link to that on the my website when I post the podcast. And wow, that's awesome.
And Train will be there, so if people are interested in seeing it, that's the place they can see it.
Okay.
In Atlanta anyway.
Great. Well, thanks again to both of you for your time, and this has been terrific. And best of luck to both of you, and I hope I get to see you soon.
Great.
All right. Take care.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.